I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is with Michael Pollan, who asks, why are the poor in America often heavier than the rich? It used to be the other way around. But first, the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe says President Robert Mugabe is using food as a way to stay in power, and there could soon be massive starvation. Mugabe's violent campaign against opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has heated up in recent days, and the U.S. ambassador says aid organizations have now been shut down, and Mugabe is distributing food largely to his supporters or opposition supporters who hand in their voting IDs, meaning they won't be able to vote in the presidential runoff election on June 27th. Well, Anglican Bishop Thomas Shaw of Massachusetts has just returned from a secret one-week trip to Zimbabwe. He says that Mugabe, a Catholic, is now also targeting members of the Anglican Church. Bishop Shaw, first tell us what you saw there. What was the general situation in Zimbabwe?
Unemployment that's between 80% and 90%, inflation that's at 1,000,000%, this brutality that's going on really everywhere in the country now, long lines at gas stations because there's no fuel, electricity being cut sometimes for 17 hours a day. So the country, compared to when I was there 13 years ago, is really in a very difficult state.
You talk about seeing virtually empty shelves in supermarkets.
Yeah.
Well, we know you went at the request of Catherine Jefford Shorey, the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, to check on Episcopalians. What's happening?
What's happening is that on Sunday, congregations are not being allowed to meet in their churches, and so they meet outdoors or in alternative venues, that vehicles that are owned by the diocese that are for the priests are being confiscated by the government, that there are riot police that are frequently surrounding churches. And there have been 3 weeks ago especially, there were beatings in parishes. There are priests that have had their lives threatened and have been sleeping not in their own homes, but every night in a different place just for their own safety.
Well, we know there are 320,000 Anglicans in Zimbabwe, which is a former British colony. Are they being singled out, or is this just part of the countrywide violence? What's happening?
Well, they're being singled out in the sense that the former bishop there, who's been excommunicated by the Anglican Church in the central province of Central Africa, is somebody who is very much in the government's pocket, and he is a supporter of ZANU, of President Mugabe's party. He's really the one that's inflicting some of this violence through the government.
And why would that be? I mean, is he of another faith? I mean, what's going on?
He was an Anglican, and because of his association with the government and his strong ties from the government, because he benefited from the government gave him a large farm, and he had been part of some of this persecution that's going on in the church, he was deposed.
Well, we know you saw incredible determination even in the face of this, that you went to one service where people were in a yard, I think. Hundreds of people came,
yeah,
despite the violence.
And great joy. I think what these people are saying is that there can be outrageous inflation, there can be political brutality, but you cannot touch my faith, and my faith is something that I'm going to stand up for. So there was great joy at these celebrations.
What do you want to see happen? I mean, what can happen?
Well, what I hope happens for the future of Zimbabwe and really the future of the continent of Africa is that democracy is restored there, and that the freedom of religion and conscience that's guaranteed in their constitution is something that is a realized guarantee.
Well, we understand the head of the Anglican Church, Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, has asked the UN Human Rights Commission to look into this denial of freedom of worship. But Zimbabwe has a host of problems. Do you see anything being done?
I do see something being done in the future. I think that this faith component, that the church is just one slice of the larger pie, but I think it's an important one, because in Zimbabwe, almost everyone is in one way or another connected with a Christian church, and while it's the Anglicans that are being persecuted now, it's clear that this could happen to any denomination in Zimbabwe.
That's Massachusetts Episcopal Bishop Thomas Shaw, just returned from a secret trip to Zimbabwe. And Bishop Shaw, the presidential runoff election right now is scheduled for June 27th. Do you have faith that it will even take place, and that if it does, it'll be above board.
I pray that it'll take place, and I pray that it'll be above board.
Bishop Shaw, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, Zimbabwe's President Mugabe was not a welcome guest at this week's UN Food Summit in Rome. As we said, Mugabe is being accused of withholding food to hold on to power. But the world leaders at the summit were mainly focusing on spiraling food costs. They ended the week calling for increased production, fewer trade barriers, and more research into agricultural techniques, although the draft declaration pretty much avoided the controversial topic of biofuels, which some countries contend contribute to the high cost of food by diverting crops from the food supply. Well, Michael Pollan spends a lot of time thinking about food. He's the Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of The Defense of Food and Eater's Manifesto. In light of current food prices and continued debate over the Farm Bill, we thought we'd hear again his thoughts from a year ago. Michael Pollan asks, why are poor people in the U.S. more likely to be overweight than rich people? Not very long ago, it was the other way around. So we began where he found part of his answer, at the supermarket. Let's go to the supermarket aisles first, because you point out something we've heard before, but you really, you know, draw a bead on it, how, for instance, the supermarket is set up and how food cost comparisons go. Give us an illustration.
Well, you know, the mystery, as you suggest in your lead-in, is why is it that people with less money should be the people suffering from the highest levels of obesity and diabetes, when historically people with less money are skinny and don't eat that much and don't eat that well? And there was a nutritionist at the University of Washington who set out to solve this mystery, and he performed a very interesting, very simple experiment. He took a dollar into the supermarket and went about trying to find out where, if you only had a dollar to spend and you were in the market for calories, which is what we're in the market for, especially if we don't have a lot of money,
right,
where could he get the most value for his dollar? And you know how the supermarket is set up. You've got the fresh food around the periphery, the milk and meat and fish and produce. It usually lines the walls. And then in the middle is the great processed canyons of snack foods and sodas and all this kind of stuff. And what he found was that a dollar bought you a lot more calories in the middle of the store.
Right.
In fact, you could get something like 1,200 calories if you were shopping for cookies or chips in the middle of the store. But if you wanted fresh produce and you went over to the carrots, you could only get 250 calories for a dollar.
Right.
So we have a situation where the least healthy calories, because those ones in the middle are the ones with all the added fat and all the added sugar, are the cheapest. And
right,
the most healthy calories are the most expensive.
So if you are someone on a real low income, you are going to be stocking up on potato chips and processed foods and the things from the middle of the store to get the most bang for your buck. You make a comparison, and it's interesting because you mentioned Twinkies in your comparison. And not too long ago, we spoke with Steve Ettlinger, who wrote a book mm-hmm. called Twinkie Deconstructed. He told us that a Twinkie contains 39 ingredients, goes through an amazing high-tech manufacturing process, and there's packaging and marketing. And you'd think that all of that work would make the Twinkie super expensive. But you make
it cost $5 or $6 for a Twinkie. When you think about all the effort and technology that goes into it, there are those 39 ingredients, and each of those, many of those, that's not simple wheat and sugar. I mean, if you read those ingredients, there are a lot of very complex molecules synthetically derived. But because of the way our food system is set up, the raw materials of that Twinkie, which are really corn and wheat and some soybeans, and of course the sweetener all comes from corn, high fructose corn syrup, you would think that that would become an expensive item of food. But in fact, those are precisely the kinds of crops we subsidize most heavily. And then you look at the carrots, and miraculously, this very simple bunch of roots ends up costing more than this complicated Twinkie. And that's because we do very little to support the grower of fresh produce.
So a Twinkie costs less than a bunch of carrots. And that brings us to the Farm Bill, as you said, how our government subsidizes farmers. Here's where my head starts to explode just a mm-hmm. little bit, because, you know, it's counterintuitive. So explain further, how is it that the government subsidizing of, let's say, corn, how does that lead to a cheaper product?
Well, in the simplest terms, we pay corn farmers by the bushel for what they can grow, so that the farmer has a strong incentive to produce as much as possible, because that will drive up his payment from the government. And the government payment to corn farmers represents up to 40% of their income these days. Now, there are ways to help farmers and support agriculture that does not lead to this overproduction. But the way we're doing it now, by essentially cutting them a check for every bushel they can grow, is bound to lead to an immense overproduction of corn and soybeans in particular. And these are the building blocks of fast food. We are, in effect, subsidizing the growing of high fructose corn syrup at a time when we have an epidemic of obesity and diabetes. It's absolutely absurd.
Are you saying that the reason that so much corn syrup goes into sodas, for instance, is because there's so much corn syrup around?
Because corn syrup is very cheap.
Yeah.
And the result is that over the last 30 or so years, since we have been subsidizing corn in this way, the amount of high fructose corn syrup each of us is consuming is up around 42 pounds a person per year. Mm. It's an astonishing amount of corn syrup.
And it's going into places that you don't even know you're drinking it or eating it.
It's now ending up in bread and pickles and salad dressing. I mean, if you go around the store looking for HFCS, or high fructose corn syrup, you will be amazed where it turns up. And the reason is that we are, as creatures, hardwired to like sweetness. So if you, as the food scientist, can work a little more cheap sweetness into your product, you're going to sell more of it.
Yeah. Well, now let me stop you there and say, but wait a second. Subsidizing farmers is about keeping land farmed as opposed to, overrun with developments. And this is just a necessary side effect of trying to keep our farmers in business.
I disagree with that. And in fact, I'm not against spending money to support farmers and keeping farmland in agriculture. I think it's vitally important. But it's really the way we do it, the way we've designed the rules of the game. In the past, before this switch to direct payments to farmers to grow as much as they can, we used to lend them money when the price of their crops dipped below a certain target. And that allowed them to take the loan money and not sell their product, hold it back in the silos. And that would take corn or wheat off the market and keep the price up. And then when the prices went up, they could sell their corn and pay back the loan. It was a system that worked quite well. But then we switched to a system of just cutting them a check whenever the price dipped below the target. Yeah. Now, this didn't make a difference to the farmers in a way. It made a huge difference to the buyers of their commodities, the Coca-Colas, the Cargills, the Tysons, all the companies who want very cheap crop prices. So that's the real beneficiary of modern subsidies. People depict it as welfare for farmers, but that's absolutely unfair. They're really essentially laundering money for ADM and Cargill and Tyson and Coca-Cola.
Author Michael Pollan talking about the connections between the food we eat and the price we pay for it and farm legislation. We'll have more. And later, risk benefits, risk premium. They say it's the hidden cost of fuel that oil companies have to pay to protect the industry in violent countries, but workers say they're paying for it. We'll tell the story of one worker who was kidnapped in Nigeria and wonders where the risk premium was for him. That's still ahead today. Back in a minute, here and now. The White House is calling it Farm Bill 2, the sequel. For the second time this spring, the White House plans to veto the Farm Bill. President Bush claims the bill is too costly and too generous to farmers. For one thing, President Bush wants to cut subsidies to farmers who make higher salaries. The first version of the bill, when it was sent to the White House, was incomplete due to a printing error. The president vetoed it anyway, but Congress had to pass a new version with the missing pages. Once the president, as promised, vetoes this version, it will return to Congress, where lawmakers have the votes to override that veto. Well, the Farm Bill is something that writer Michael Pollan has been watching closely. We spoke with him last spring as the bill was being debated then. He told us that federal subsidies encourage the overproduction of a handful of crops like corn, soybeans, and wheat. And he told us how that affects what we eat. I asked him to explain how the legislation has repercussions beyond the U.S.
The reason the Farm Bill is such an important piece of legislation is that it not only affects our food system and what we put into our stomachs, but in fact, it affects the world's food system. When Americans can sell corn or other commodities so cheaply overseas, we essentially sell them for less than they cost to produce. So when you dump that kind of corn on, say, Mexico, as we did after NAFTA was passed in 1994, you are putting all those Mexican farmers who can't produce it that cheaply because they're not being subsidized out of business. And essentially, since NAFTA, 1.5 million Mexican farmers have been tossed off the land because they couldn't compete with cheap, subsidized American corn. Same is true for farmers in Nigeria trying to make a living growing cotton. They can't compete with the American cotton coming in, which is being sold at less than it costs to produce. So it has a very distorting effect on the world economy, and it is, as people like at Oxfam will tell you, it is one of the very most important impediments to raising the income levels of farmers all over the world. And it's not as though it's helping farmers. I mean, farmers have been going out of business regularly. This system leads to ever lower prices because the more that's produced, the price goes down further. And that is not a boon to anybody except the buyers of this stuff and people who, you know, like junk food, because it is what makes junk food cheap.
Well, and we should say that it not only does it have an impact on farmers in Mexico, but you draw the line to a higher rate of illegal immigration as they come across the border here, as we send corn there.
Exactly right. If you're throwing farmers off the land in Mexico, what are they going to do? They're going to either go to Mexico City and find themselves impoverished, or they're going to emigrate to the United States. So you really can't understand the pressures driving the flow of people north unless you understand the pressures of the corn moving south. That flood of cheap corn is partly responsible for the tide of immigration.
It seems like a pretty tightly woven system at this point. I mean, you've said that you don't think this is as much about supporting farmers as supporting the junk food business, but mm-hmm. people don't want to see farmers go out of business. I mean, what has to happen in your mind to change it?
Well, I think we have to figure out a new way to support farmers. I think we need to pay them for being good stewards of their land, for example. There are programs like the Conservation Security Program that Senator Harkin introduced last farm bill that essentially pays them for taking good care of the land, not for producing as much as possible. So you can change the incentives so that you get a food system that is based on quality, both of farming and of the crops coming off the land, rather than sheer quantity.
Because as you write, this isn't just about the Twinkie. This reaches all different communities. The public health community has to recognize it can't address obesity without addressing the farm bill. The environmental community has to recognize that if a farm bill promotes chemical and feedlot agriculture, we can't have clean water. And the development community has to realize that global poverty can't be fought without confronting the farm bill.
And all those constituencies just now waking up to the fact that the farm bill, which everybody used to think was this parochial issue involving just Midwesterners, but the farm bill is really a food bill, and it affects all those issues. And until we look at the farm bill and try to align our agricultural policies with our public health, our environmental, and our development goals, we will have no success in all three of those areas, because farming, as we're practicing it now, is the biggest source of pollution in this country, the biggest source of cheap calories making us fat, and the biggest impediment to third world farmers getting ahead.
It strikes me, Michael, in reading your article, that the community most affected by this is the one with the least voice. The people who are activists in these realms are pretty much buying their organic food at farm stands and have, you know, a small revolution going on in their own lives. But poorer people
cannot take part in that revolution right now.
Right.
I think that that's true. And I think we're moving to a bifurcated food economy where healthy food will only be affordable to people with money in the middle class and upper middle class. And that's just a crime. I mean, that the poor can only afford these fat and sugar calories. But there are things that can be done to level the playing field between these unhealthy calories in the middle of the store and these healthier calories on the periphery. And that's really what we have to focus on, is mechanisms to either drive down the cost of fresh produce or raise the cost of artificially cheap junk food. Because, you know, it may seem cheap, but in the long run, of course, those cheap calories are incredibly expensive to your health, to the public health, to the environment. And if we calculate the real costs of cheap food, we realize it's not such a bargain.
That's Michael Pollan, the Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, also author most recently of The Defense of Food and Eater's Manifesto. We spoke with him last spring. In just a quick moment to look ahead to a story we're working on for next week. We have a fascinating conversation about how the high-tech industry is attracting people with Asperger's, a form of autism. It allows people with Asperger's to focus on their complex work without a lot of social interaction for which they lack skills. An Asperger's advocate tells us how employers can make life easier for people with the syndrome by doing simple things like replacing fluorescent lights.
A lot of people can see the strobing of a fluorescent light that can induce really disabling headaches and, mm-hmm. and inability to function. I think unexpected sensory input, sudden sensory input, is just one part of it. And I think that interacts with the social part, because one spends a lifetime figuring out what the expected responses are going to be, because there's one's own natural intuition about how to respond may not agree with the majority.
Do you have thoughts about the story? Does it apply to you? We want to hear from you at here-now.org. Let us know. That story's coming up next week. Still to come today, with the Belmont Stakes this weekend, we'll look at an alternative to slaughterhouses. After the news, here and now. We hear a lot of reasons for the high price of oil. One we don't often hear about is the risk premium, the cost oil companies say they pay for security in places that are rich in crude but increasingly dangerous. The risk premium is calculated into every barrel of oil, so consumers pay at the pump. And oil workers pay a personal price, as we're going to see in our next story. Joining us from station KUHF in Houston is Mimi Schwartz. She writes about the risk premium in the current edition of Texas Monthly Magazine. Mimi, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's nice to be here.
This risk premium is something that many oil industry workers in Texas are familiar with. Your article begins with the story of Russell Spell, and he was working in Nigeria. What happened?
He was working on an oil barge laying pipe for an offshore rig, and the barge was stormed by a group of either terrorists or freedom fighters, whatever you want
depending
to call them.
Yeah,
and 19 men were kidnapped. And it was workers from all over the world, but it included 3 Americans and 1 Brit.
And Russell Spell, who was one of the Americans kidnapped, was an employee of Wilbro's Group. That's a contractor, a subcontractor. They were working for Shell in the area?
Yes, and they've worked together in Nigeria for 40 years or so.
Well, now the group that kidnapped him is a group called MEND. This is the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. It stems back in Nigeria to, well, the execution of Ken Saro-Wiwa, who was an environmentalist leading the fight against a corrupt government and his country being overtaken by the oil industry.
Yes. I mean, basically, what's happened is the capital, Abuja, and the wealth is located in the northern part of the country, but the resources are in the south. So the money gets sucked out of what was once a very beautiful region, but has now been a totally despoiled region in Africa. No one really has regulated the companies coming in there, and so it's led to a lot of civil unrest and an amazing amount of pollution.
Well, and Russell Spell learns this as the group takes him further and further into the jungle, as his company and Shell begin negotiating to try to get the hostages back.
The story is really something out of Joseph Conrad. Russell, like a lot of oil field workers, has been able to make a good living without a college degree doing this kind of work. And he'd been in Nigeria for over a decade, loves the Nigerian people, but hadn't really kept up with political changes in the region. So Russell really had been hired to work in the middle of an escalating civil war.
Well, and he becomes a player in all of this and starts to ask questions like, well, if there is such a thing as a risk premium, and I'm, you know, paraphrasing his thinking, why wasn't that money spent here? He didn't seem to have the protection a worker should have had. The oil industry companies involved had warnings from these groups that there were going to be attacks. Other workers had been moved out. He wasn't. So is there some question as to whether or not there really is the premium part of the risk that companies are really paying to protect workers like Russell?
Spell talked to me a lot about the company having financial problems, and every time you shut these rigs down, it costs an enormous amount to start them back up again. So Wilbros maybe was playing a game of chicken a little.
Well, Russell Spell was going to speak to us as well today, but he's having a lot of problems. He was eventually rescued. He returned to Texas to his wife and two children, but then was plagued by nightmares, flashbacks. After all, he had a gun held to his head at one point when he was kidnapped. He's having a hard time getting his life back together.
Well, the way I like to think of it is, it's just like the contractors who went into Iraq. Nobody really took seriously that these people could suffer the exact same problems as the soldiers. And that's really what happened to Russell. Every day that he was in captivity, his life was threatened. There were times when these men were marched out into the jungle and guns were held to their heads, and they were told, today's the day, you're going to die. And then the captors would collapse in laughter at the joke. It's an enormous risk to these guys. You know, they really are like soldiers in the war for filling up our SUVs.
Well, he has these terrible feelings of feeling lost, but he still goes back to work for Wilbros. He needs the money. They send him back to Nigeria. He goes. They offered him a slight raise. Has a terrible time. Shortly after that, his company runs into money problems. They cut his pay in half, then lay him off. He's been formally diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. What is he doing right now?
Well, it was his understanding that he had been promised a job in Houston and is currently suing on that point because he has no job right now. He can't work, but he did not want to sue this company. He was a loyal employee, loved the company, loved his job, but at a certain point he felt that he had no recourse.
So Russell Spell is now suing both the Wilbros Group and Shell Oil. Meanwhile, he lives back in Houston where there's a large population of Nigerian immigrants, which are just a no fault of their own, a reminder to him of his trauma. But also, he gets emails from his former captors that seem to remind him that they're still out there.
Yes, he never feels safe. And when he was kidnapped, they told him, we can find you anywhere. Don't ever say anything bad about us because we can take care of you. And he did receive this email from one of the guards in the camp where he was held. And it said, happy to know that your family's doing fine. I really longs to hear from you often. Lest I forget, are you still in your country or your company had taken you to other destination? And, you know, some of us might have taken that as just, well, nice to hear from you. But I think for Russell, it was a reminder that they could always find him.
Do you have any idea? I mean, what does the story tell us, Mimi Schwartz? Do you have any idea how many workers does Russell Spell represent? I mean, certainly maybe not that vicious a kidnapping, but how many have health problems because of the work that they've done in dangerous zones? And what exactly is the thinking about what needs to be done?
Since 2006, 128 foreign nationals have been kidnapped, and groups like MEND have shut down 25% of Nigeria's oil production. That's 14% of our oil imports. I mean, we import 14% of our oil from Nigeria, so that gets very risky. What's hoped is that if people are going to go into places like Nigeria, and it's not just Nigeria, it's now becoming the border of Venezuela, it's the former Soviet Union, it's a lot of places around the globe, people can't go in there just thinking that they're working in the Gulf of Mexico. They've got to be trained, and the companies have got to accept some more liability for what can happen.
How about not going in there, you know, not going into countries like Nigeria where a huge portion of the population so resents they see the oil industry as raping their land.
Well, as one Nigerian told me, they don't really see the oil companies as some do and some don't. The main enemy is their own government, which I think, you know, if the government were to be more generous with the profits that they make, I think some of these problems would go away. But I think now there's so few places on the globe left where the oil is readily available that we're all going to have to confront this and our part in it.
Mimi Schwartz, a writer with Texas Monthly Magazine, her story on Russell Spell and the risk premium appears in the current edition. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Mimi, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. It was a pleasure.
And before we go to today, the folk arts of just one state, as we'll see, globalization has been going on for a long time. You're listening to Here and Now. Big Brown has won the Preakness and the Kentucky Derby, and tomorrow he runs in the Belmont with the hopes of winning horse racing's Triple Crown. But then what? Well, maybe the slaughterhouse. Don't scoff. Ferdinand won the Kentucky Derby in 1986 and was reportedly butchered in Japan for pet food. And in many countries, people eat horse meat. There is legislation pending in Congress that would ban the shipping of horses for slaughter. It's backed by groups like Veterinarians for Equine Healthcare. But still, around 100,000 horses are slaughtered every year. As many as 15,000 are believed to be thoroughbreds, and some of them only a few years old, but too worn out to race anymore. Well, enter Lori Lane. She loves racehorses. In fact, she works at a racetrack. When she's not running, the nonprofit group Rerun, a New Jersey-based organization, one of dozens across the country, that prepares racehorses for a second career and then puts them up for adoption. She joins us from her home in New Jersey. Lori, first of all, how do you get these horses?
Trainers or owners call us and ask us if we could intervene and take the horses into our program, or others that we get at auction are purchased by private people and then donate them to our program.
Right. People go, there are these auctions, and the people who bid on these horses are called killer bidders, we understand, because it's understood that they're going to go to slaughterhouses, and people will go and approach them and offer them a few dollars more to take the horses to groups like yours. Well, then what do you do? I mean, these racehorses in particular have had, I'm sure, a very different kind of life. How do you retrain them for adoption?
The first 4 weeks, we kind of just call downtime, and we kind of let them be a horse again.
And we understand for many of these horses, it's also a detox. They've been on a lot of drugs to help them race.
We find that at times, a lot of the substances that they're given are, you know, legal at some tracks.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So some of that stuff still takes a toll on them.
And then what do you do?
We assess them and evaluate them, but for the most of them, we try to give every one of them a job. We start riding them under saddle, the ones that can't be ridden under saddle. We do various things with them just to keep their mind current and involved in life.
Well, we know some of these horses become beautiful show horses. They learn how to jump. They become pets. Police officers are often interested in these horses, so they can have a very valuable second life.
They have very valuable second life, and they make a lot of people happy, and they just love being a part of life. They, you know, on the track, they're used to interacting with humans every day.
Well, and how many horses can you take in?
Right now, we house 40 horses.
Well, but that's, you know, that's a drop in the bucket. You know,
it is.
How
it
do
is.
You make the bigger change so that people understand that there is an option for horses?
I think education. I think there has to be some self-responsibility. You know, going to the races, watching your horse run, going to the winner's circle, but you have to think about the big picture. You want to jump into owning a horse, it's a forever commitment. Yeah. So after racing's done, you should have plan B. I always say that these horses need to have their own little 401ks.
Well, and there are going to be people who want that $500 per horse that mm-hmm. they get from selling the horses for pet food, for slaughterhouse, for other reasons. But a lot of people don't know that that's what happens. We're reading that there are people who sell their horses thinking that they're going to another life in a farm somewhere, and actually they're getting on a truck for a slaughterhouse.
That's true. That happened to me 2 years ago. I got a call from somebody hysterical saying that they gave the horse to this lady that promised the horse was going to be in a kid's camp in a riding program. Well, that should have been red flag number one. You can't take a horse off the racetrack and put him in a kid's camp within 2 weeks. And these were the trainers that were hysterical. I mean, they were just, you know, somebody goes nicey nights and pets them. And then in turn, this person's driving off laughing to themselves because they're taking them to auction. They're putting their money in their pocket. And so you got to beware. I always say you got to do your homework.
Lori Lane is president of Rerun. They're based in Helmetta, New Jersey. They rescue racehorses. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Lori, thanks so much for telling us about your work.
Thank you.
Okay, coming up, when you think Massachusetts, do you think tap dancing? Well, maybe you should, as we're going to hear. We'll be back in 1 minute, here and now. How do you encapsulate the folk art scene of an entire state in one exhibit, especially when a state has no boundaries when it comes to folk art? New forms flow in and out. That's why there are hand-woven Nantucket baskets and hand-wrought English door knockers, alongside Armenian needle lace, Malaysian swords, and Puerto Rican wood carvings of santos, or saints, in a new exhibit here in Massachusetts. It's called Keepers of Tradition, Art and Folk Heritage in Massachusetts. The works were gathered by Massachusetts Cultural Council folklorist Maggie Holtzberg and others, and she joins us in the studio. And yes, you are the state folklorist.
Yes, I'm pleased to be, and there's somebody in almost every state in the country that's doing the same job.
I love hearing that there are folklorists out there everywhere. Well, who knew that, you know, you think you're going to start with, Irish step dancers, but no. The state can claim tap dancing, at least the late Jimmy Slide. He was born in Boston. He just recently died. And the Mass Cultural Council funded a grant for him to work with a student.
Yeah, a student named Rocky Mendez, who grew up in the town next to Jimmy, who is actually known as Dr. Jimmy Slide. Mm-hmm. And he loved dancing, and his mother brought him over to the house, and he eventually convinced Jimmy to take him on as a student.
We're going to hear some sound of Dr. Jimmy Slide working with his young protege. But just tell us, what's the importance of Jimmy Slide? What is the heritage that's being passed on here?
This is a tradition that's really best passed on from feet to feet. And he is a member of a quickly vanishing generation of master jazz tap artists around the country.
Let's listen as Dr. Jimmy Slide works with the young Rocky Mendez.
Say it so we know.
Slap.
Oh, and what is it on the other foot?
Brush, shuffle, slap.
Lift.
Mm-hmm. Brush, shuffle, slap. Lift. Toe.
So, Maggie, tap dancing, what was the, you know, how did you decide what got into the show?
Well, it's based on 8 years of folklore fieldwork around the state to identify people that are carrying on traditions, craft traditions, music, dance traditions, and are exemplars of those forms in their communities.
Well, and let's hear more of what you found. I know when I think Massachusetts, I think Norway. What was the Norwegian influence that you found?
If you go to a community such as New Bedford or Fairhaven, you'll find that there's a sub-community there of people from Norway that came here specifically because of the fishing industry. So once you have a concentration of Norwegian Americans, it's a little easier to go into that community and find fabulous craft artists or musicians. And in this case, we found a woman, Eileen Drivdahl, who does beautiful Hardanger cut work.
Hardanger cut work?
Hardanger is a region in Norway, and so a lot of people came from there and settled on the coast, the south coast of Massachusetts.
And what's cut work?
It's white on white embroidery, but then you cut away.
And by the way, there are going to be pictures. You can go to our website, here-now.org. But you cut away from
the
embroidery.
Away the places, so there'll be little square holes throughout this form. So that tradition is still being carried on. And also a wonderful music tradition, the Hardanger fiddle. The one in the show is made by a local maker, Dave Goldberg, and it's played by a man named Toby Weinberg, who has taught and lived in the state for many years.
Let's listen. So we hear the influence of Norwegians who came to fish, over 100 years ago. But we also have the impact of more recent immigrants. The kora, the sound of the kora, from Africa?
Yes, from West Africa, from Mali. There's a young man named Bala Tunkara who comes from a family of griot. Griots is a form of oral historian, singer, poet. And he plays this harp-like instrument built on a huge gourd with 21 strings.
The sounds of the kora from Mali in Massachusetts. Not surprisingly, Maggie Holtzberg, you're show includes a craft section, and the craft section includes things that make sense here in New England. Ship's wheels, weather vanes. Let's talk about the ship wheel maker first. Who is he?
He's Bob Fuller, and he lives in Halifax, Massachusetts. And he comes from, I guess, three generations of his family were boat builders, wooden boat builders. But Bob specializes in handmade ship's wheels.
Some people consider it to be a piece of furniture. And I look at a ship's wheel as being far more than a piece of furniture. I mean, the furniture is made to stand up on the ocean in a really harsh environment. A ship's wheel needs to perform. It needs to be there when you're using it.
That's the ship's wheel maker. What about the weather vane maker? We recently had a terrible fire here in Boston. It wiped out a famous harbor landmark, the James Hook and Company Lobster Company. Just if you've been a tourist down on the harbor, you knew this, you know, red shingled place where everybody got lobsters. But one thing was salvaged.
Yes, it's going to need a little work, but there was a beautiful lobster weather vane on the top of Hook Lobster, and that was the landmark that told you where you were. There was a picture in the Boston Globe recently of one of the owners, Al Hook, kissing this sort of mangled remains of the weather vane. But what's wonderful is the maker of that weather vane lives in Hawley, Massachusetts, and probably will be pleased to get it back to shape, you know, what it was when she first made it. And her, one of her pieces is in the Keepers of Tradition.
Well, so here we've gone the entire segment, and we haven't mentioned Irish step dancing or storytellers or, of course, the Irish influence here in Massachusetts is just, I mean, so valuable. You want to comment on one accordion player in particular?
Yes, this is a man named Joe Durain, who was born in Boston of Irish immigrant parents and discovered a love of the accordion when he was quite young. Not only did he play weekly as a teenager in the Dudley Street ballroom scene, but he also made some recordings when he was 17 that went on to become legendary in the Irish music world.
And to many of us, this is one sound, you know, the Irish sound that started, you know, in the 30s and 40s. But he tells you that to his ear, they were distinguishable.
You'd have a musician from Galway, you'd have one from Sligo, you'd have two from Cork, or you'd have one from Kerry. You'd hear these guys playing the same tunes, but they're all a little bit different. So out of that, I think you got what I heard very early on, oh, I can tell you're from Boston, a Boston style. And I think that's maybe where that arose from, that kind of mixture.
So we've had a little taste of Massachusetts here. And I'm just wondering, I mean, you know, if people dig into their own state culture, I bet they would find that they'd be surprised at what they'd find there.
I think that's true. I think on the surface, people think of a state as being homogeneous, black and white. But basically, when you do a little digging, you find that there's incredible diversity and people continue to come to this country for its freedoms and the opportunities that are here. So yes, you would find maybe not these particular ethnicities, but other ones.
Maggie Holzberg is the Massachusetts folklorist. I just love that. She's with the Mass Cultural Council, and their new show is Keepers of Tradition, Art and Folk Heritage in Massachusetts. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Maggie, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.